Welcome to the Being Curious Show. I'm Brian Mariani, founder of No Shift Own.
And I'm Kelly Wagner, publisher of Edge Magazine. Our show is about curiously connecting teachers and seekers on a wide range of topics in a safe space. Few topics will be off limits, and we have some amazing guests to share with you.
Our intention is that our conversations will spark your own curiosity to create a life that lights you up and inspires you to be kind, thoughtful, open-minded to yourself and others.
We are on AM 950, Sundays at 2 p.m. and all podcast platforms. So, Brian, what are you curious about today?
Oh, man. Here we go. I have a lot of curiosity today. And one of the curious things about our show today, Kelly, is that we are actually recording on Valentine's Day. And our guest, this was obviously not going to air today, but our guest has decades and decades of absolute masterclass, just all kinds of amazing things about love. And it's just so synchronistic that we're having this conversation today. So I'm super curious about what's going to happen today on Valentine's Day, and really excited for everyone to hear it when it actually airs. So our guest today is Dr. Donna Marks. She's been a licensed psychotherapist and addictions counselor in Palm Beach, Florida, for over 30 years. In 1989, Dr. Marks developed a chemical dependency training program in Palm Beach Community College, which has grown into a four-year degree and received the Florida's Governor's Council Award. She has multiple other certifications. She has written two books. Her website is drdonnamarks.com. But we're a lot more concerned with who you are, Dr. Donna, truly. And I know our audiences as well. And we're going to get into all the accolades and the amazing things that you do and have done. But we really also want to get to know you. And we want our audience to get to know you, because we believe that the better they get to know you, the more likely they'll be to actually reach out and connect with you. And that's the best win that could happen today, is that someone listening to this, there's something that's said that has them feel compelled to have the courage to actually reach out. And so for all of those people, tell us about really what set you on the path that led you here today. Can you remember one of those first experiences that you had that started to get you curious about, you know, maybe what it might be to be a psychotherapist, or that you really wanted to serve people? Or take us back to maybe one of those first experiences you had.
And welcome.
Okay. All right. So thank you very much for having me on the show. I'm very honored, and it's my mission to save as many lives from addiction as I possibly can in the rest of my life. So any opportunity to speak to an audience is really a gift, and I'm deeply grateful. I was raised in an environment that, as a child, was very painful for me. And fortunately, one way of coping with that pain was I had some sense of a spiritual connection. There was messages that I was getting, like, it's not your fault. And that helped me. And that helped me really well for a long time, until I started copying the kind of behavior that I was witnessing in my teens. I started veering off in the other direction. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying that's what happened.
Right.
I don't think I could help people had I not experienced addiction myself and mental health issues. And I don't think I could have become a healed healer had I not had the journey that I've had. But as a teenager, I was like the resident therapist for my friends and even family members. So I knew right away, like in eighth or ninth grade, that I was probably going to be some type of psychologist or psychotherapist.
So it really started very early on. I love that. And so I think there's a really interesting path that then happens, which is this high level path where you're being recognized as someone who can listen, and maybe you're even saying things that people are going, oh, wow, that makes a lot of sense, or I feel really heard, or, you know, Donna at the time, you were just Donna, right? So Donna gets me. Donna understands. And then there's this period where, you know, you have your own experiences. Some of them are good. Some of them are bad. Maybe even your own touches with addiction and trauma and things like that. So how do you navigate those parallels of being someone recognized as maybe a little bit different and then also going through your own pain and struggles?
Well, I think a lot of us have kind of diverging paths, you know, between our human experience and our spiritual experience. And it takes a while, sometimes a lifetime, before they converge. And these human experiences can be integrated into the spiritual mission. And that's what's happened for me now. But I was definitely, you know, going like this along the way, for sure. I was married at 16 to get out of my dysfunctional family and start my own. And I was 18 and divorced with a little 2-year-old girl and working as a waitress, and really struggled, immensely struggled. And then most of that was because of my own experimenting with substances, especially alcohol at the time. But every time that I did make bad decisions, it was always when I was drinking or doing other things. It took me a long time to understand that there's just one addiction and that it'll move around. But anyhow, that's part of the process, and that's what I write about in the book.
That's interesting. You just teed me up, because I was going to say, why do you say there's only one addiction in the world?
Well, I believe it's that emptiness inside. I call it the invisible hole.
Yep.
And we're constantly trying to fill it, you know, sugar, food, sex, porn, gambling, shopping, distractions, videos. It's just relationships, love, sex, you know, it's just never ending. And so one of the things that happens in recovery is that people will address one addiction because it's the one that's obvious and killing them. But when they stop that, then they just start another thing, like I did. I just kept switching around. I had no idea of that concept. And so one of the really important things that I'm helping people to understand is that if I quit smoking, I'm probably going to start eating sugar. You know, if I stop eating sugar, I'm probably going to start eating something else. If I stop cocaine, I'm probably going to gamble. Or if I stop gambling, I might do cocaine. You know, it just keeps, it's a vicious maze. That's why I call it exit the maze, because we don't really get out of the maze. We just keep going down, up and down different corridors, looking for that fix.
So why do you believe that 50% of treatments fail?
Well,
because they never come out of the maze and they just keep going.
Yeah,
they just keep going down another. Okay.
Exactly. And, you know, I've had a lot of experience with treatment centers over the years, and it's so disappointing, because when I refer someone, I don't like to refer to treatment. I like treating them individually in the office, but sometimes people have to be detoxed or they have to be contained in a safe environment. Mm-hmm. And so there's always a plan. Like when they get out, I make recommendations, and often in treatment, they're not on the same page with me because they haven't been working with the person. They don't understand the severity of how this addiction moves around for a person. For example, I'll send someone to treatment for, let's say, sex addiction, alcoholism, and work, and they won't really comprehensively address that. The person leaves, they go back to their house, they're lonely, and the first thing they do is hooking up on these apps. And then the people they're hooking up with are people that they used to use with, and so on and so on and so on. So it's not really comprehensive and really the thorough understanding of addiction. And that's why treatment fails, in my opinion. And by the way, 12-step programs have as good of, if not better, a recovery rate than treatment programs.
So in your vast experience in dealing with addiction and seeing that, really clarifying that it's, it shouldn't be viewed as one or the other or this or that. There's a central issue at play, whatever the addiction is. Is addiction always negative? What I'm getting at is there, like if your addiction is to eat healthy, like you create a habit out of eating healthy and sleeping and working out and things like that, is that a completely separate thing? Or are you simply filling the void with something better than sex or alcohol?
Well, that wouldn't be better then, would it? That might be better for you.
Better for you. Maybe not more fun, but better for you.
Today is Valentine's Day.
I know. That's why I was like, let's just bring it on.
Yeah. Every addiction is a substitute for love, in my opinion. So what's happening with the addiction? We're going for that hit, which makes us feel that false sense of love. So we're making an attachment disorder to the addiction instead of what would really feel good, which is human relationships, eating healthy, sleeping, you know, doing good self-care, self-love, and to be connected and having a purpose and a mission. That's a natural high that is also connected, that's integrating your life with your spirituality. And when I say spirituality, I'm talking about what makes you feel connected, not me, but what makes you feel connected to the bigger picture. And so that's my message, is that, it's not really an addiction to eat healthy and sleep right, unless you go bananas when you don't get to go running or you don't get to have your healthy meal. That would be a negative consequence, and then that would be an addictive mindset.
And so really piggybacking on that, what can you say are the green flags for, let's say, a habit and the red flags for an addictive behavior or an addiction?
Well, they're probably very closely intertwined, so that's a little bit of a slippery slope. Some people feel more comfortable saying they have bad habits. To me, a bad habit is like you can't go out of the house without your tennis shoes every day, but there's really no negative consequences to it. You know, to be flexible is, or to be inflexible could be a bad habit. But an addiction is something that you continue to do despite negative consequences. Hmm. You have a legal problem, you have a family problem, you have an emotional problem, your brain becomes dysregulated, your life becomes unmanageable. And so that is directly related often to the addiction, that there is negative consequences. Bad habits, they usually don't have very negative consequences. A bad habit might be speeding. You know, you have a negative consequence of getting a ticket occasionally, but it's not going to ruin your life. It's just going to be an expensive lesson.
Right.
And so what have you seen as a really effective trigger? Let's say someone isn't able to sit down with you in person or virtual. They're out in their life. They're doing something that causes some very real consequences. And then they do it again. And so the trigger is, okay, there's something really wrong there. What would be something that people could take away from this conversation that if they're out in their life and they see that happen, they can help move in the other direction from that?
So, what am I really curious about? That's one of the things that's really piqued my curiosity, is why do we allow ourselves so freely to get hijacked? You know, our minds literally get hijacked. Things are made to get us addicted. Alcohol doesn't have to have that high of a proof. Refined sugar is certainly a lot more addictive than cane sugar or natural sweeteners or even raw sugar. I mean, everything that we get addicted to, it's on purpose. It's not an accident, including prescription pills and a lot of other things, as we know now from opiates. But that's really, to me, just the tip of the iceberg. You can go right down the list. They're all very addictive. I'm talking about mood-altering prescription drugs. I'm not talking about all prescription drugs. And even some of the antidepressants, you know, they say they're not addictive, but when I work with people who've tried to get off of them, oh my God, they go through a huge withdrawal, emotional and physical, nightmares, can't sleep, can't eat properly, can't function. They feel like they're in outer space. It's awful. So it's really, that's my curiosity. Like, what would it take for someone to just say, am I doing something that's not good for me? And why is it so hard for me to let go of it? You know, the hardest part about any addiction is deciding to let go of it. And as the 12 steps say, which is very effective, one day at a time, not forever, but just one day at a time. And after a couple of weeks, when the withdrawal process is over, it becomes quite easy. I teach people how to look at it like any bad relationship, you know, break up with it and give yourself time to get over it. And don't think it's going to be better the next time, because it's not going to be better the next time.
Well, if you keep going into the same approach? Or, for example, when you said the person got out and then the first thing they did is go to the app that they were used to and attracted the people that they were used to. I mean, you just fall back into that that cadence, that rhythm.
Exactly. Exactly. Recovery is about replacing the addiction with love, because what's happened is you're using it as a substitute for love. So what do you need to do to replace that? And what I talk about in my books and give many examples of is learning how to love yourself. I was sober for a long time and relapsed. And I realized in that relapse, when I'm railing, you know, like, well, I'm trying to do everything right. How come this has happened? You know, why don't you love me, God? And it became very clear to me, it's you that doesn't love yourself. And that was like a really huge awakening for me. Like, what does that even mean? Because those of us that were raised in these environments where we were loved, but the way that it was demonstrated was not enough to really feel it and to feel a value to ourselves. So it's learning how to do that.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, you guys, great segment one with Dr. Donna Marks, author of Exit the Maze, One Addiction, One Cause, One Solution. We will be back. It's Kelly and Brian, Brian and Kelly, Being Curious. Thank you.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Being Curious with Kelly and Brian. We are here with our amazing guest, Dr. Donna Marks, and we're really diving into love. And yeah. And you keep coming back to love, and even in your own personal adventure through life, you found that in this time of relapse, the issue was your own self-love and your own self-care, and that was a major moment for you that shifted in all the ways that allowed you to move through that. And, you know, again, I think we have a very unique opportunity here because you've been working in this field for so long. The data and the experience that you have is so valuable for someone to hear. And so I'd be curious if you have seen what are some of those things that people go through that allow themselves to be more prone to fall into an addiction. Do you see, kind of with the many, many people that you've worked with individually and just everything that you've learned over the years, do you see that, again, are there areas to really pay close attention to because they kind of set you up to be more likely to fall into something like that? Maybe just shed some light in that area.
Well, I think in most cases, but not all cases, there's been some kind of early trauma that made a first person feel inferior in some way. And so by the time they start school, and especially by the time they start high school, there's this really high anxiety level. I'm not okay. I'm different. I don't fit in. And by the way, almost all teenagers go through that to a certain extent. So part of it is like preparing people for it and letting them know it's normal. But for people who've had trauma, it's intensified. So the first time, and they want to be a part of, they want to be accepted. So the first time they're at the party and someone passes them some drugs or alcohol or whatever the case may be, they do it without even thinking because they want to feel that connection. And then once their brain is, you know, on the off position for the anxiety meter, and they feel fine, they feel great, you know, then it gets doubly reinforced. And often we're off and running after that. When can I do it again? More. When's next?
Right. That's brilliant. It creates that loop of, I guess, the positive feedback loop, except it's not positive. I guess a negative feedback loop where they're doing something and the brain becomes more and more trained that's the answer. But I want people to really get that it doesn't have to be the complete answer. There are ways to break that cycle and create another loop that says, you know, I feel good and healthy. And that's the loop that keeps coming back around. That's the confidence builder. That's what builds connection to your own self and to other people. So talk about how both exist and that it's not a life sentence. There's massive possibility and opportunity for anybody to shift that, as you did in your own life.
Right. Well, I think that if you're not being taught at home the dangers of certain addictions, and I mentioned them earlier, then to be able to be aware yourself, do you really want to ever start that? There are rare people who have been raised in really traumatic and substance abusing and all kinds of addictions going on in their environment. And yet they say, you know, I don't think I want to, a smart man learns from their mistakes. Wise man learns from watching other people's mistakes. Right. And children are usually very wise if they're not overly traumatized. So they can step back and say, you know, that's fine. I'm not going to judge anybody for smoking pot or drinking or, you know, whatever they're doing. We have a whole new level now of raising kids to be really addicted because of video games and immediate gratification. I want it now. I'm entitled to it now and all that. But to be able to step back and say, you know, I want to have control of me. I'm in charge of me, not advertising, not my support system. I'm in charge of me, and I have the ability to make good choices. And I also have the ability to direct my life. And what do I want to do with my life? And I may not know yet, but I'm going to start figuring it out when I'm a teenager, when I'm in my 20s, so that I do have that fulfilled life. I don't need to go off the cliff to be able to experience the good things in life. It's not necessary.
Gosh, I wish I would have met you when I was like 15.
Yeah, I wish I would have met me when I was 15. This version.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is kind of an interesting question, but do you believe there's a way to legalize drugs in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, most drugs are legalized except, the ones that are illicit. But I mean, we've legalized pot prescription drugs. Like I said, I mean, we all know about the Oxy and what it did to people. That's probably one of the worst drugs ever on the market. It's certainly worse than anything else out there except fentanyl, which is killing so many people.
Right.
But they're pretty much tied, the opiates and the fentanyl, by the way. Fentanyl is an opiate. So when you hear about fentanyl killing 100,000 people, that's not really accurate. It's about 50-50 between prescription opiates and illegal opiates. Because people start taking more and more, and then if they have a little bit of Xanax on top of it to calm them down, or they have a drink, their brain shuts down and doesn't wake up. So in my opinion, and this is very controversial, we have cigarettes are legal, alcohol's legal, prescription drugs are legal. Maybe we should legalize everything so that we can control what's going into a person's body, tax everything just like they do alcohol and cigarettes, put in major prevention programs, starting with the time when a woman's pregnant and how to properly nourish herself and that fetal development so that they have a much less chance of having some type of what they're calling brain disorder, which I don't agree with that either. But, that baby's born really healthy, and then have these pamphlets for mothers. What are the things that your baby's going to need to feel a good self-esteem growing up? Mm. And, you know, how to deal with the emotions and things like that. You know, just a little pamphlet. It doesn't have to be a big old long book, you know, like a 10, 12 page pamphlet. And use this tax money instead of teaching some of these things that they're teaching in school, which only causes more anxiety. Right. You know, teach kids like how to love themselves, even if they don't have it in their home. They're, you know, teach them that they have a good mind and they can make good decisions and the benefit of that. There's so many things we could do with taxed drug money. Because we're never going to control it. The government is not the solution. We are the solution. We, each person, is the solution to the problem. We're not going to control it coming over the borders. We're not going to control people using it. By the time they use it, they're often running, as we just talked about.
Right.
But we can start with that fetal development. We can start with early childhood. We can start with, if you wait till they're in high school, it's too late.
Right.
I'm talking about teaching kindergartners how to love themselves.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, it's a total shift. And it's a very, it is the answer. It's one of those things that's so obvious. And yet, why isn't it? Why haven't we figured that out? We know how important In other words, there's no scientific research or any doctor or scientist that would say in any kind of public setting that the brain of a child is heavily formed between the ages of whatever it is, 0 to 8 or whatever that time frame is. We all know that that's a very, very important period of time. So why wouldn't we be fronting the education? Why wouldn't we be fronting the training? Why wouldn't we be doing all of those things at that early stage, knowing that you're 10xing someone's ability to actually retain, understand, and utilize that kind of information?
Well, not only are they not doing that, they're doing just the opposite.
Right.
They're saying that you're born with a brain disorder, like as if there's a gene that says you have to smoke your first cigarette, you have to drink your first drink, you have to shoot heroin, you have to do video games 10 hours a day. I mean, that is the most ridiculous thing that I've ever heard. And it's supported by the DSMs and the ICD-9 diagnostic manuals that we have now. We don't have addictions, we have brain disorders. Well, you know why you have a brain disorder? So you can treat it with addiction. Here's your pills for your brain disorder. And that just really sends me to the moon and back. That's why I say nobody's going to fix this but us.
Right.
It has to come from a demand, an upswell of people like you and I and Kelly and everyone else that go, we just demand it to be different. And we're going to do it on our own accord until you have to just do it.
Yeah.
Probably because they'd figure out some way to like make money at some level, which is fine. But truly, this is why these types of conversations are so important, because some mom or dad or someone out there might make a decision today to take this into their home and go, okay, I'll take responsibility for this. And every single time that happens, it makes a difference, because a child who is raised in that kind of environment becomes someone far more capable of handling the first time they go to a party in high school and the first time and the first time and the first time. And so
handling life.
Yeah.
Well, think how much we've normalized alcohol in our society.
Right.
Right. You do something great, you get a drink. You have a terrible day, you have a drink. You have this, that. I mean, look at the Super Bowl ads. It's advertising. It's normalization,
right?
That.
Well, we've normalized all of it. Pills.
Oh, that's true.
Sugar, food, you know, one of the things I talk about in my book is that almost all mental and medical conditions are related to addiction. Why? Because people don't realize they're addicted. They think they have a bad habit. You know, they eat too much sugar or they eat too much fried chicken or whatever. They're addicted. They don't realize that they're addicted, because if they weren't addicted, the minute they started having symptoms related to that particular substance, they would stop. But no, people don't stop because their doctors say, oh, your cholesterol is high, here, take this pill. Or, oh, your liver's got some fatty, you know, tissue going on, here, take this pill. Or take this pill, do this or do that. No one is saying, stop. Let's look at what's causing this mental disorder and this physical symptom. No, they wind up getting cancer, diabetes, liver disease, lung disease, stroke. It's almost all related to alcohol, drugs, sugar, and trans fats.
And it truly comes back to the source, as you're saying, of giving away your autonomy. You're basically saying, well, I can make all these mistakes and there's a pill, or I can do all these things and there's some, you know, how to lose 30 pounds in a week, and there's all of these
quick fixes.
There's all of these quick fixes, right?
And, treat addiction with addiction, as I say.
Exactly. Right. And, you know, it's I love that we're having this conversation, because in my own adventure through life, all of this is very present to me every single day. And the way I've kind of have conversations with my own mind is I'm actually obsessed with my own self-care. And maybe obsession is not a great word, but when I attach it to my own self-care, it allows me to be tenacious in that area of my life. And it becomes a game. And I think you were talking before about really building connection. And there's really no better way to get to know yourself than to really understand who you are, like to actually spend the time to be aware enough and conscious enough to see who you are,
how your mind
what
works.
Your interests really are, yeah. How your mind works. So I'd be very curious as we go into segment three to really dive into, again, how you've seen all of that play out in your professional experience, in your personal experience, because it's there is something very attractive about games. We watch them, we play them, but we don't often take the time to play the most important game, which is our own adventure through life. And so we'll be back with Dr. Donna Marks, and we'll see you in segment three.
It's Brian, it's Kelly, it's Dr. Donna Marks, and I said her name right, so I'm really, really excited about that. Her website is drdonnamarks.com. You know, I wanted to kick this segment off as you have a recent blog about ladybugs. Tell us about ladybugs and the unwillingness to change.
Well, thank you. Yeah, so I bought some new plants for our patio, and I noticed that there was this growth coming on one of the plants, kind of like a cancerous growth, like kind of like an addiction crawling up the stems. But anyhow, I wanted to treat it homeopathically, and so I read that I took the app off the phone, you know, to diagnose what was wrong. It said that there was some type of mealybug infestation. And I could see the little mealybugs from time to time, so I knew that was true. And I found out that ladybugs are a natural predator of mealybugs. So I went online and Googled it and ordered a little packet of 1,500 ladybugs. That's the title of the blog that you're referring to. Everyone got a kick out of that, by the way. And anyhow, I noticed, you know, I opened the bag and I shook it a little bit. Most of them just kind of went out, and then some of them, you know, would not go out even for a week, you know, like shaking, and they just would not leave that bag. But it was so interesting because I drew such an analogy to people. You know, some of the ladybugs went flying off, you know, into wherever. Some of them were, you know, propagating over by themselves somewhere, just doing what they're kind of wired to do. And some of them would just not leave that little bag. And I said, you know, so much like people, some of us are adventurous and we'll go off dangerously into the unknown. Some of us, you know, just want to stay with somebody and cling on to somebody. And some of us will just do what we're here to do. And, you know, that some of them just went around looking for food and shelter in this beautiful philodendron plant that I had. And then some just would not leave that little safety. It wasn't their home. They weren't born there, I don't think. And they just would not leave it. So I did a little one-page blog on using that as a metaphor for how people will often do those same behaviors.
What a great
it was a great blog.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And it was just right in your life, and you were able to, you know, pull all the parallels out and share that with the world.
Thank you. I really like creative writing. I'm a nonfiction writer, but it's fun to do the creative writing.
Yeah, for sure. It lights you up. Talking about love, it's definitely part of your own self-love.
It's the answer to everything. It's the answer. You know, no matter what's going on, if we come from love, there's a solution, and it's a win-win solution. But unfortunately, we're taught to be afraid. Either we grew up in a fearful environment where we're scared, So we learn to, you know, to protect ourselves, or we think we're protecting ourselves and all of our stuff, you know, my booze or my lover, or, you know, right. my blankie, whatever the case may be. And so we learn that, and we're afraid then to go out, you know, to go out, not necessarily flying haphazard across the universe, but, you know, to come up with a natural, you know, we all have in us a natural desire to love and be loved and connect and to fulfill our mission here. And so when stuff blocks that from happening, we have to reconnect to that to enjoy life. Otherwise, we're just giving up something we enjoy for what? But when we give up something we enjoy for an adventure, for excitement, for passion, for real true connection, we don't even think about the addiction anymore. I don't even think about it ever. And I had a lot of them.
And that's really, it speaks to one of your most central messages throughout your work and your books. And it really is this very simple question: how do we substitute an addiction with love? And, you know, this is a question that you have, again, worked diligently on for decades and decades. And it's in your books, it's in your work. And so, you know, I'm curious, and I'm sure our audience is, like, how do you do that? What are some of those ways?
Well, and the book, I talk about ways to love yourself. But first of all, to treat yourself as if you were the parent and of yourself, the small child. You know, I said, I wish I would have known me when I was 15. That's what I meant. You're like, there's a parent in me to parent the human being me that is developmentally delayed and didn't know how to take good care of myself with love. And so part of that is physical. The other part is emotional, like how to manage anger and how to manage sorrow and how to manage grief in positive ways so that I'm purging those emotions and not keeping them bottled up inside, churning that invisible hole like a router, you know, right. making it bigger and bigger. And so that's a big part of it. But then I also tell people, you know, if you have an addiction, you're an expert. And they're like, what? I said, you know, if you have a drug addiction, you know more about the pharmaceutical manual than anybody. If you have a food addiction, you know all about food. You know, whatever, you know, people who are alcohol, you know, wine connoisseurs, I mean, they can convert whatever their addiction is into a profession. So it's like a food addict becomes a gourmet, healthy food chef and creates meals and writes cookbooks and coaches other people. A lot of times people with substance abuse problems become in the field of addiction, and you can go way out in about 100 different directions with that. You know, people who are video addicts, they have that electronic mind. They can create apps. So whatever, you know, whatever your addiction is, you can convert that, because really it's just a misguided thing already. Right. So you kind of like, When you're at the crossroads like me, instead of going this way, went this way. And so I can just go back, bring that addiction over to this way, to my career, to my passion, to my future, and use it to help other people. Then we've got a love thing going on rather than giving up and the fear and what am I going to do with my time and what about this and what about that and it's going to feel so bad and blah, blah, blah. None of that happens because I am now in my creative, spiritually heightened state. And good things are happening.
So in Exit the Maze, One Addiction, One Cause, One Solution, you thread through the entire book with all these beautiful stories of friends and clients and just people that have crossed your path. Any stories that come to mind that you'd like to share with our audience?
Was there one that really that you could relate to?
There was so many, I have to say, and I took a couple notes. But not off the top of my head, because I remember throughout, I would just get so excited when you brought in another one and you brought in another one, another one. It was lovely. And I just want to thank you for those stories.
Well, thank you. You know, the same thing, nothing pops right into the middle of my mind. I try to give a scenario and then use live examples. Of course, I change the names and the circumstances so that people's privacy isn't invaded. But there's just so many wonderful stories of people who were able to face their addictions, their codependency addiction, their substance addiction, their food addictions, and actually fill that with a wonderful life of love and happiness and joy.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. So you have brought up earlier, and I think it was segment one, about that, how do you break up with an addiction like a bad relationship? Because I think when I was reading the book, when I read that, I was like, oh, how many people, if you could look at it that way, because I would say an addiction with a substance that's not showing your body love is a bad relationship. I mean, let's just like, right, how do we do that? And how many people stay in bad relationships, both emotionally, physically, mentally, spiritually? And you parlaying, I just, for me, that was such a beautiful light bulb that went off. And I was like, oh, it is so simple.
Yes, yes. You know, there's a great ad now, and it came out after I wrote my book, where this guy's going to break up with his, he's got a bad relationship, it's called debt. And so he's going to break up with his credit card. Of course, they're trying to get you to get another credit card.
Right. Yeah, that's always what happens.
But, you know, all the friends hanging around and everything. Yeah. So it is, you know, a good relationship is positive. There's not negative consequences. And even when you're fighting or you have a problem, there's growth there, and people are committed to growing through that. And addiction isn't interested in growing through anything with you. It's interested in claiming your life. That's the bottom line. To separate you, to pull you out of the herd, to take you all to itself. And then it's just you, and then it becomes pathological, you know, where I don't want to be around people, I don't like people, da 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 da, and then eventually I'm so lonely and so empty that addiction literally fills that hole and consumes me. And the goal of any addiction is to bankrupt you or to kill you.
No, it's true. Okay, so I did think of one of the stories that I liked. It was about the mother that the son just released out of a 12-step program. And on his anniversary date, she wanted him to have like a little baby drink or a little baby this, a little baby that. Because, of course, she's dealing with her own stuff.
Right.
Right. And with, and she thought she was being motherly with this.
Yeah.
And
I don't know that she thought she was being
motherly. Well, I was trying.
Yeah. You know, sometimes alcoholics have a real hard time when other family members get sober. So they will unconsciously or consciously sabotage it. And I feel that in this particular case, she did everything she could and successfully sabotaged his recovery. That particular person also had a parent who the parent was in recovery. The parent sent the son to me. And the parent died of opiate overdose. Yeah. The parent relapsed on substances and died. So I have no idea what happened to that particular young man, but it was bordering on evil. Scott Peck wrote a book called People of the Lie, and he talks about people who just live this lie and they don't care who it affects, and particularly with their own children. It was really unfortunate, really, really sad.
Yeah. So
she was in getting, you know, when I work with people, I have a concierge practice. I work with the whole system, whether it's a business system, a family system, a lover system, it doesn't matter, because if everyone's not on the same page, this is what happens. And this is what happens in treatment too, a lot, by the way. You know, I have worked with someone and got them prepared for sobriety. And then I say, if you don't address this sex addiction, if you don't address this gambling addiction, and if you think that this person is going to be well after 30 days of treatment and that they don't need to go on to the next step of residential treatment, this person is not going to stay sober. I know that because I know the person very, very well. And I see it all the time where they will sabotage the plan, or the you know, they don't agree, or they're afraid, or, you know, a million different reasons. It's really sad. All that work, you know, for death or relapse.
Right. Yeah.
So it's really important for whatever the system is to everybody to be on the same page.
So I think this is a really critical point to hone in on as we wrap up. And I'd love for you to share, you know, in beautiful, sweet words, what would be your message to everyone out there? And again, our time is short, and, you know, I wish we had more time, but what would be the message? If one thing today was heard, what would you want that to be?
So I want you to picture yourself being born and coming into this world, and what a beautiful, innocent being that you are. and that you chose to come here. And no matter what the circumstances are, you have a purpose and you have a mission. And you are here to share and receive love. And as long as you're doing that, you're sharing, you're being, you know, I always say, you know, people say, oh, I want love, I want love. Well, be it. You have it in you. So be the love that you want and you will have the love. And so that's what I teach people. You know, you tune into that part of yourself. Don't tune into the fears, the can'ts, the it's too scary. So I could never do that. You know, you can do it. You can do, and what you want to do and what your vision is in you for a reason. So tap into that. Tap into who you really and truly are and don't believe anything else and follow that. Follow that.
That is so that's powerful. Thank you, Dr. Donna Marks.
Hey. Thank you.
You guys, Exit the Maze, One Addiction, One Cause, One Solution is out now. Amazing book. I read it. I was inspired by it. And that's the reason why Dr. Donna's here today. DrDonnaMarks.com. Just be curious, you guys, wherever you are. And on Valentine's Day, love yourself, love others, and be kind and be curious. On behalf of Brian and Kelly and Dr. Donna Marks, happy Valentine's Day. Be curious. And thanks for joining us today.